Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, NASA announces a new big rocket. Star Wars gets real with a planet that orbits two stars. And do scientists feel pressure to produce positive results? Here's a scientist soundbite.
This new heavy lift rocket will be America's most powerful since the Saturn V rocket that carried Apollo astronauts to the moon. It will launch humans to places no one has gone before, such as asteroids, Mars, and other deep space destinations.
That was Charles Bolden, head of the U.S. space agency NASA. More with him later, but first, Emily Howard joins us for Science News of the Week. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge. La Niña has returned and is forecast to strengthen this upcoming winter, according to a report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Climate Prediction Center. La Niña typically brings warmer and drier conditions across the southern United States and an increase in precipitation for the Pacific Northwest and Ohio Valley. With another round of La Niña developing, more extreme weather could continue for the remainder of 2011.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Appropriations proposed on September 14th to allow NASA's James Webb Space Telescope enough funding to realize the project, with a telescope launch still possible for 2018. In the summer of 2011, the House of Representatives had voted to cancel the project, which was over budget and behind schedule. This move by the Senate, which comes with a stringent warning to NASA to be more accountable in executing the project, has revived hopes that the $6.5 billion space telescope will eventually be completed and launched.
2 million-year-old fossil skeletons uncovered in South Africa might reveal the earliest known link to modern humans, according to a series of 5 reports published in September in the journal Science. The fossilized bones show features of both modern humans and of non-human apes, according to the researchers.
The Milky Way galaxy's existing spiral arms might have formed from a collision with a small galaxy named Sagittarius, according to research by UC Irvine astronomers published September 14th of 2011 in the journal Nature. Sagittarius is a satellite galaxy to the Milky Way. The little galaxy is known to collide with our galaxy periodically. At present, this little galaxy is about 70,000 light years from Earth and expected to collide again with our galaxy in about 10 million years. If these periodic collisions do help create the Milky Way's spiral arms, then this research sheds light on the fate of this strange little Milky Way satellite and on the old question in astronomy of how spiral galaxies maintain their spiral shape.
Astronomers from the European Southern Observatory have announced the discovery of more than 50 new exoplanets, planets orbiting distant suns. Among the 50 are 16 super-Earths, one of which orbits at the edge of the habitable zone of its star. The HARP spectrograph on the 3.6-meter telescope at ESO's La Silla Observatory in Chile discovered these 50 new worlds. This is the largest number of exoplanets ever announced at one time, according to these astronomers.
Science interviews after this. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, broadcast on 1,200 stations around the world and on Voice of America. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden announced on September 14th that the U.S. Space Agency will build a new advanced heavy lift launch vehicle, basically a big rocket, to go beyond the orbit of Earth. Just before announcing the rocket to Congress, Bolden first delivered this personal message on it to the public.
The next chapter of America's space exploration story is being written right here, right now. We've selected the design of a new space exploration system that will take humans far beyond Earth. This important decision will create high-quality jobs here at home and provide the cornerstone for America's future human space exploration efforts. This new heavy-lift rocket will be America's most powerful since the Saturn V rocket that carried Apollo astronauts to the moon. It will launch humans to places no one has gone before, such as asteroids, Mars, and other deep space destinations. While I was proud to fly on the space shuttle, tomorrow's explorers will now dream of one day walking on Mars. This launch vehicle decision is the culmination of a months-long, comprehensive review of potential designs to ensure that the nation gets the best possible rocket for the investment. One that's not only powerful, but is also evolvable, so it can be adapted to different missions as opportunities arise and new technologies are developed. We must continue to challenge ourselves as a people to reach our highest potential.
That was NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Join the community for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird joins us to talk about a new study that suggests that scientists might feel pressure to only report positive results. Hi, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. This study came out the week of September 12th from scientists at the University of Edinburgh. And what they're saying is that they looked at studies conducted between the years 1990 and 2007. And during that time, the number of positive results, that is, results where the conclusion of the experiment agreed with the original hypothesis, the number of positive results rose from 70% in 1990 to 86%. 6% by 2007. So what that means is that scientists are getting more positive results for their experiments, and that's a very interesting thing to find out because, you know, what's going on here?
So, Deborah, tell us about the scientific process. How does that work?
Well, so science is supposed to be the impartial study of the world, and scientists are trained to be very careful observers of the world. And so scientists observe, and as they're observing, they begin to get ideas about how things work. But in order to sort of frame their ideas, they create what's called a hypothesis. So a hypothesis could be something like, say, if you jump out of an airplane without a parachute, you're going to plunge to the ground. You know, that's logical. It sounds like that could happen. That's my hypothesis. I'm not personally going to conduct the experiment to prove that.
Don't try this at home.
That's right. Don't try this at home. But in science, it's that type of thing. Something sounds logical to you. Based on your observation of the world, you form your hypothesis, and then you conduct your experiment. When you get a positive result, that is, your result agrees with your original hypothesis. In fact, in science, the negative results are just as important, but what seems to be happening here is that journals are printing the articles with the positive results more than the articles with negative results.
So, Deborah, are scientists just getting better at asking the right questions?
Well, they're either asking questions. That's a very benign thought, actually. These scientists had had a couple of other alternatives. One of the things that the scientists said might be that happening is that the journals where scientists are reporting these results might be preferentially only taking the studies that have positive results. And what would be the reason for that? Well, when a study has a positive result, it's more likely to be cited in other places. And when that study is cited, of course, the journal is cited, and that's good for the journals. So the journal might be preferentially choosing those. Another thing may be something we've heard quite a bit about with the global warming debate, that scientists may be manipulating their data to get positive results.
Yeah, but this study has no evidence that shows that that is happening, that any scientists are manipulating their data, right?
The whole idea that scientists would manipulate data to me is just kind of absurd, really. I mean, there may be scientists out there who do that, but for the most part, I think that scientists are people who truly are looking for the truth. And the idea that they would manipulate their data is, you know, to me, just almost kind of laughable. So I don't believe that myself. But it is part of the public debate on global warming. There are lots of people out there who don't believe that global warming is real, or who don't believe that global warming is caused by humans, who use this phrase, manipulating data, to indicate that scientists are only showing that Earth is warming in order to get grants. Like, we hear this over and over. They're just doing it to get grants. And, you know, seems wrong to me, seems crazy to me. But now here comes a study that suggests that, you know, it's in that vein. It's saying that, indeed, positive results, the number of positive results in scientific papers increased from the year 1990 to the year 2007 by 15%.
Yeah, and it should be pointed out in this study by the University of Edinburgh, it looked at almost 5,000 papers, that that these trends of these positive scientific questions were not really found in climate science.
No, they were strongest in economics, business, clinical medicine, psychology, psychiatry, pharmacology, and molecular biology. So, you know, a lot of the financial area or the life sciences area, not climate science. But, you know, this is a question that is important for all of us, the integrity of science. Can we believe the results of science? Is science trustworthy?
And it's just as important for a scientist to find evidence that disproves his scientific question, his hypothesis, as it is to find evidence that it does support it.
Well, absolutely. A negative result in science is just as important as a positive result.
Yes.
So this conversation, Jorge, is ongoing. This is actually in my, you know, 35 years of working in science, talking to scientists, reporting on science, this subject has been there for all of those 35 years. People say now it's getting worse, the situation is getting worse, because, of course, like every other field, science is highly competitive now. There's a lot of competition to get jobs, and you have to be published in the highly rated journals to get the jobs. So, you know, I'm here today to just say, let's talk about it. Let's bring this subject out in the open. Let's just ensure, all of us, that science is as trustworthy as it can be, because science is a tool that we in the 21st century are gonna need.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Science fiction has become reality in the announcement by NASA that a planet far, far away is the first ever discovered to orbit two suns, just like the fictional Tatooine, homeworld of Luke Skywalker in the movie Star Wars. NASA's Kepler mission, which features a planet-hunting spacecraft, discovered this world unlike any known so far. On the line to talk more about it is astronomer Alan Boss of the Carnegie Institution for Science. He's a co-author of the report in the journal Science that describes the findings. Dr. Boss, welcome.
Thank you.
What are the main findings of the report you've co-authored in the journal Science on a planet that's found to orbit two suns?
Well, the Kepler mission was launched 2.5 years ago to look for Earth-like planets. And as an unintended byproduct of that search, what this team has found is the very first really strong evidence for a planet in orbit around a close binary system. That is, two stars orbit themselves, and then a planet is orbiting around both of those stars. It's sort of a system that had been envisioned back in the 1970s in the very first Star Wars movies. And it's taken us 35 years for the science fiction to finally become reality.
What do scientists know about this planet? People listening may be familiar with, as you mentioned, the planet from the movie Star Wars, Tatooine. Yep. I don't know how to pronounce that. But it's the planet, the home planet of Luke Skywalker, desert planet. What do scientists know about this real planet that is orbiting two stars?
So this new planet is probably not like Tatooine, which is more or less a rocky, dusty, deserty, hot, Earth-like planet. This new planet is a rather cold gas giant. The best analog would be our own Saturn and our solar system. The new planet has roughly the mass of Saturn, roughly the radius of Saturn, and so therefore roughly its density. It's less dense than water, and it's quite cold. The surface temperature is probably about 200 degrees Kelvin, which is about minus 100 degrees centigrade. So it's kind of like what the surface temperatures might be in Antarctica on the very coldest winter day. So it's not a planet that you would be able to stand on its surface. It's probably a gaseous surface. But if this planet had a few icy satellites in orbit around it, those temperatures would be, again, sort of like on a very cold day in Antarctica. And the amazing thing is, because the stars at the center of the system, there are two of them, with very different masses, so they would have very different colors. If you were living on that one of those satellites, putative satellites around this Saturn-mass planet, every time your satellite rotated around, you would see these two stars come up in the morning and set at night, and it'd be quite a spectacular sight. It'd be a sight that would change because the planet's period would not be locked up with that of the star's rotation period. So one time you'd see the two stars rise essentially simultaneously, and the next time it might be a couple hours between when one star comes up and the next one. So it'd be very unpredictable sunrises and sunsets, which would be, wreak havoc with cocktail hour on that planet.
It's kind of throwing me for a bit of a mind bender. People listening may be familiar with the elliptical orbit of Earth around our parent star, the Sun. How does this planet orbit two stars?
It actually is on a fairly stable circular orbit, much like our own Earth's orbit around the Sun. Even though the two stars in the center are doing their own thing, wobbling around each other, with a somewhat eccentric orbit, the planet's orbit is actually pretty close to circular, so it's pretty stable. And the two stars' masses actually add up to being very close to the mass of our Sun. One star is about 70% the mass of the Sun. The other is about 20% the mass of the Sun. So together, they're about 90% the mass of the Sun, which means that from some points of view, it's kind of like they act very much as if you simply had a star with a mass 90% of the mass of the Sun at the center, which means you can have a nice stable orbit if you're far enough away.
Where is this planet, and how was it found?
The planet is orbiting a star or a system of stars in the area of this constellations Lyra and Cygnus in the northern hemisphere. That's where the Kepler target field is. Kepler is studying about 155,000 stars. And one person, Larry Lawrence Doyle, who's the lead author on this paper, may has made eclipsing binaries his specialty. He says, "I'll take care of the eclipsing binaries. You guys go off and do your thing. I'll do the eclipsing binaries." And he's been surveying a number of them, and he found this very first system where he noticed that there were four types of dimmings of the system. There is the primary and the secondary transit, where the primary and the secondary star eclipse each other periodically. Then in addition, there's our tertiary and quaternary transits, when the third object, which we now know to be a planet, first blots out some of the primary star's light and then some of the secondary star's light, then the primary, then the secondary, back and forth. So the fact that you see all four dimmings, all four transits, implies absolutely definitively that this thing has to be in orbit around both of them. And by looking at how the timing changes from when the eclipses occur, you can figure out how massive that third object has to be. It turns out to be a mass roughly that of Saturn. So by doing a lot of detective work, here's a case where we found for the very first time absolute definitive proof that a Saturn-mass planet is in orbit around a very close binary star system. And the most amazing aspect of this whole thing is that basically anywhere you can think of looking for a planet where it could be on a nice stable orbit, we often start finding them. We find them around dwarf stars or around giant stars. We find them around single stars, binary stars. Now we find them around close binary stars. It's just amazing that practically every little niche that could be populated by a planet, Mother Nature has seen fit to go ahead and put some there for us. So it's quite startling, especially when you realize that 16 years ago we had no evidence for any other planets around Sun-like stars, and now we have so much, as I said, thousands of examples of planets, and they have been there all this time. We just didn't know they were there. So it's kind of like the whole universe is like a cloak is being pulled away from our eyes, and we're seeing the universe with new eyes and realizing, my goodness, there are planets in orbit around just about every star you look up on the sky. There are planets around just about every one of them.
That was astronomer Alan Boss of the Carnegie Institution for Science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mellow Grand, Sleep Good, Sounda, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't hurt us.